Hey, folks, it's The Takeaway for Tuesday, January 23rd, 2018. Remember, if you like this podcast, you can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a rating if you can. We appreciate it. Thanks.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. We begin this hour in Syria. Americans haven't heard a lot lately about the ongoing war in Syria, but there's a new front in that war with complicated and high stakes for the United States. In recent days, Turkish forces have crossed into northern Syria, going after Kurdish militias there. On Saturday, dozens of Turkish jets bombed the mostly Kurdish city of Afrin in northwestern Syria. Then Turkey escalated on Sunday with a ground incursion. The United States does not like what it sees. It objected to all of this. Turkey is a NATO ally, and the Kurds have been valuable U.S. partners fighting ISIS for years. Still, Turkey is not interested in American warnings here. More than a dozen people are reportedly dead as a result of the clashes. And on Saturday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan promised to follow the assault on Afrin with another assault on the northern town of Manbij.
We will wipe out this corridor step by step, starting from the west. Afrin operation has de facto started in the field. This will be followed by Manbij. Since the promises made about Manbij have not been kept so far, nobody can say anything when we do what is necessary.
Sarah L. Deeb joins me now from Beirut. She covers Lebanon and Syria for the Associated Press. Sarah, there's a long history of animosity between Turkey and Kurdish groups. What's behind this latest conflict?
Turkey is quite angry at the growing influence of the Syrian Kurdish along its border. It's been developing for the past years. In 2016, Turkey entered Syria for a military operation to basically stop them from forming a contiguous territory along its border. But the recent flare-up, although we know that he's been preparing for this operation for a while, has been really connected to the U.S. recent announcement that it's also going to help form a new border force that's led by the Syrian Kurdish militia that's been the U.S.'s main ally in the fight against ISIS. And then things spiraled, as we've seen it, in the last couple of days.
So is it fair to say then that this latest flare-up, this latest violence between Turkey and these Kurdish groups are an offshoot of the ongoing war in Syria and the war against ISIS?
I would say it's actually a reflection of the tension between Turkey and the U.S. All what you said is true, but it's also a reflection of how deep the rift has become between Washington and Ankara over the Syria policy and other things, but the Syria policy is at the heart of it. The Syrian Kurds were the U.S.'s main ally in the fight against ISIS. Turkey didn't take this very well. It wanted to be the partner. It didn't work out for many reasons, but it's also a new front in the war in Syria, a particularly bad one and a particularly hard one to predict the outcome of. It's basically pitting the Turkish army against various players in the area.
Talk about some of those players. Who specifically are the Kurds in this situation that Turkey is fighting, and who else is a factor here?
The scene in Syria is quite complex on so many fronts. There are so many players, so many fighters, so many countries. But I think the Kurdish component is also quite complex in its own right, because they are a minority in Syria that have long complained of being ignored, marginalized by the government, but they also extend beyond Syria. They are an ethnic group that exists in Turkey, they exist in Iran, they exist in Iraq, so they have a self-determination question that's going on for years, but they're also armed, so that takes a whole new element to the Kurdish question. But in Syria itself, the Kurdish militia in the east has been a major player in a fight against Daesh or ISIS with the US-led coalition. The Kurds in the west have not been part of that fight, because the Kurds in the west of Syria are an enclave, isolated enclave, but they also have been viewed by Turkey as an extension, particularly the ones in the west, as an extension of its own insurgency in the south of Turkey. So it's quite a complex set of players, and the U.S. has also been in a tough position trying to explain its cooperation with the Kurdish militia that Turkey accuses of being a terrorist, and a component of that Kurdish group does not take part in the war against Daesh. So now we're having the Western enclave in Syria come under attack from Turkey. While the U.S. does not exist or does not have any troops in that Western area, it is embarrassed or is in a tough spot because one of its main allies in Syria is coming under attack from Turkey. So you see, I cannot, it's a chessboard that's really complex and quite intricate. And I think that's also part of the reason why we cannot really predict the outcome of this current conflict.
Well, Sarah, Turkey has vowed, meanwhile, to expand this offensive. How much further could this go?
We can see that Turkey's angry. We can see that Turkey's not heeding any of the calls for restraint or has not sought a diplomatic track on this. Erdogan has threatened that he will go after Minbij, which is another Kurdish-controlled town on the other side of Syria, as in the east of Syria, but it's along the Euphrates rivers. And Minbij is quite important because Minbij was a town that was controlled by Daesh. The Kurdish militia, along with the U.S. coalition, have managed to clear ISIS from the town, and they've now turned it into a model, or they want it to be a model for governance and a coexistence between Arab and Kurds. And for Turkey to actually go after this, it would be even more of a stronger message to the U.S.
Turkish troops and tanks crossing into Syria going after Kurdish groups, both allies of the United States. Sarah L. Deeb, Associated Press correspondent covering Syria and Lebanon. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, on Monday, the UN Security Council called a session to address this Turkish operation into northern Syria. And U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson from London urged both sides to show some restraint here. But as you heard the AP's Sarah Aldeeb say, this new front represents a major problem for the United States, a strategic partner fighting with a faithful ally. So what is the impact on American strategy in Syria? Ambassador Frederick Hoff is back. He's former special advisor for the transition in Syria at the U.S. State Department. He's currently director of the Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. Ambassador, welcome back.
Todd, it's good to be with you.
Well, as we've already learned, this is complicated from the U.S. perspective, Ambassador. All of the Syria war is. But here's Turkey, a NATO ally, crossing into Syria to strike at the Kurds, a key U.S. ally in the region. What kind of dilemma does this represent for the United States from where you sit?
From where I sit, Todd, it presents a potentially very, very dangerous situation. The area where the Turks are intervening right now is well removed from the location of American forces working on the final defeat of ISIS in eastern Syria. Nevertheless, there is a possibility of Turkish, Syrian, Kurdish violence in this extreme northwestern corner of Syria spreading along the border and ending up east of the Euphrates River, where American forces are located. So you have a possibility of NATO allies actually coming to blows.
In any other situation, the United States might feel called upon to go and defend those Kurds, but in this case, that would only mean helping to fight another NATO ally.
Well, it would, Todd. And look, I suspect that the Turkish government hopes to keep the fighting isolated to the Afrin district. But others have a vote here. Imagine this Kurdish militia suffering high casualties, taking a severe defeat in the northwest of Syria. What is to prevent it from launching mortar attacks, for example, across the border into Turkey in eastern Syria, thereby provoking a Turkish response? And potentially we're off to the races, and American advisors in eastern Syria could find themselves in great danger.
This sounds like the type of operation where the United States says to Turkey, please don't do this. Erdogan says to the Americans, we're going after these factions, but don't worry, we'll stay east of the Euphrates and we won't go west. And it's wink and a nod and a new war starts.
You know, once the fighting starts, all bets are off. And a key element in all of this is Russia. The Russians have gingerly stepped to the side. They've moved their forces away. They've opened the airspace to Turkey. From the point of view of Vladimir Putin, the best result of all of this, the ideal result, the dream result, would be to see two NATO allies confronting one another over this.
Do the United States and Turkey have the wherewithal to talk to each other on the side and make sure their planes don't wind up in accidental engagements or something bad doesn't happen between these two NATO allies?
You know, the United States Air Force and Naval Aviation are not active west of the Euphrates River. So there is no American air presence in the area where the Turks are conducting their incursion. I think what's very important right now, the need for close and sustained communication between these two NATO allies is incredibly important. And the United States, actually, believe it or not, does not have an ambassador in Ankara. I think there's a strong inclination on the part of the U.S. government to try to square the circle between Turkish concerns and Kurdish fear of being abandoned by the United States once ISIS is finished. This will be a diplomatic heavy lift for the United States. From my point of view, as someone who's once worked in the State Department, the question is, who is going to do the heavy lift? We desperately need an ambassador in Ankara. And until we have one, I suspect what we need is a very senior presidential special envoy to basically camp out with the Turks, and so that the president of Turkey believes that the president of the United States is being represented at an appropriate level.
Well, Ambassador Frederick Hoff, I won't ask you to predict the outcome of such chaotic fighting, but based on what you know about Turkish intentions and the geography of this northwestern corner of Syria here, would you expect the fighting to remain isolated to these enclaves west of the Euphrates, or is there a significant risk that it could spread to the east?
I would say both, Todd. I would expect, and of course I would hope, that the fighting would be restricted to northwestern Syria. The Turks, I suspect, will stop the operation once they've established a buffer zone, a security zone. But there is a profound, profound danger that this could spread to eastern Syria and bring the Turkish and the American military into direct, if inadvertent, contact.
Ambassador Frederick Hoff, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure speaking with you, Todd.
Ambassador Frederick Hoff, director of the Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this week marks 45 years since the Supreme Court's landmark decision in Roe v. Wade.
Well, the decision, as I tell in Abuse of Discretion, the inside story of Roe v. Wade, was a great mistake. It was a self-inflicted wound on the court.
That's Clark Forsythe. He's senior counsel for Americans United for Life.
The court had no evidence, no trial record, no evidence about abortion or its implications, no expert witnesses, no reliable medical data. They were shooting from the hip. And the Roe versus Wade opinion itself, written by Justice Blackmun, has been trashed by scholars for 45 years.
Well, this week we're looking at abortion rights 45 years after Roe. And for 33 of those 45 years, Clark has worked in the courts and with state legislatures to restrict abortion, with an eye in the next few years on the ultimate win, overturning Roe versus Wade in the Supreme Court.
The decision took the issue away from the American people, set us on a course of being one of four nations that allows abortion for any reason after fetal viability, ranked with China, North Korea, and Canada, one of only seven nations that allows abortion for any reason after 20 weeks. And it set us on an extreme course that is out of sync with public opinion, and the decision should be overturned and returned to the American people so the people can decide the issue state by state.
Now, what do the practicalities of that fight look like for you, Clark? Does this mean going to the states, coming up with test cases, test laws that can filter up to the Supreme Court?
Well, there's actually an urban legend out there that you need the perfect case, the perfect record, the perfect prohibition, a complete 100% prohibition to create a test case. You could have a 20-week limit. 21 states have passed a 20-week limit since 2010, actually. A 20-week limit could form a test case like the one that was signed in Ohio by Governor Kasich in December. Any statute challenged in court, in federal court, state court, that arguably conflicts with Roe versus Wade or Doe versus Bolton could form a test case. It could be a limit on public funding that supposedly conflicts with Roe, parental notice or consent law, informed consent law, clinic regulations. Any of these could form a test case because in those cases, the court has to decide, are we going to apply Roe or are we going to apply the Constitution or some other standard? And since we've got a 5-4 pro-abortion majority on the court right now, there isn't going to be a test case anytime soon.
So returning the issue to the states is interesting to me, Clark, because I wonder how you envision an America where Roe is overturned. Ostensibly, abortion would be illegal in some states, legal in others, let's say New York, California, places like that. We've had lots of people on this show pointing out that all that would mean is that women with the means, with the money, would be able to travel from the states where abortion is illegal to the states where it's legal. Abortions wouldn't stop, but you would have essentially a two-tiered system where people with money would get legal abortions, people without money would seek illegal abortions, which would still go on. Do you agree with that vision that that's essentially what would happen if it were simply left up to the states?
I think that's largely bunk. You're talking as though you're back in 1930. And much has changed since 1973. Of course, you know, some of the people you've interviewed were talking about abortions back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Well, in 1961, we had the pill. And we've had multiple technological changes that have introduced new contraceptives. You can now use multiple forms of contraceptive to reach, you know, virtually 99.99% effectiveness. Society has substantially changed since 1992. In fact, since I suppose 2006, the abortion rate has dropped significantly. It's the lowest it's been since like before Roe versus Wade. I think it's also important to point out that if Roe versus Wade was overturned today, abortion would be legal in 45 or 50 states tomorrow simply because there is no abortion prohibition on the books before 20 weeks or fetal viability. So if 99% of the abortions, or I think it's 90%, occur in the first trimester, they would be virtually unaffected in the short term until the issue went back to the states and they affirmatively acted in one way or another. I think over a period of time, you would see the states adopt a more anti-abortion policy than the Supreme Court's edict, better in line with public opinion than the edict. And since abortion takes a human life, the life of a growing, developing human being, abortion shouldn't be easy to obtain anyhow.
Why are you in favor of abortion law being handed back to the states? Why not in favor of a personhood amendment or some policy that recognizes that abortion takes a human life? If that's the case, it's hard to imagine an acceptance of it being legal in many states across this country.
Our country is founded on a federalist constitution. We have a federalist system, and Missouri and Alabama and Iowa can adopt a different policy than Washington State or D.C. or New York State or California. And I don't see that, you know, that there is any one national solution, one national rule that could be approved by the American people, at least at this time, and establish one standard. I mean, that's the fallacy of Roe versus Wade. The court, the judges from Washington imposed one national rule on the country. And precisely, I think one reason why they failed is because they attempted to do that.
So, Clark, if people want to watch closely in state legislatures and state courts for where the perfect test case or the perfect test law might come to eventually challenge Roe v. Wade in Washington, point us toward one place or one policy where you might suggest people might watch closely.
Generally speaking, it would be the red states rather than the blue states. So it would be more realistic to look at states where there are Republican governors. And we do have legislatures in 25 or 30 states that have pro-life working majorities in both houses. It would be also important to have an attorney general who will defend the law and take it up to the Supreme Court. So that's the South and the Midwest, the Southwest, Southeast, Midwest, from North Dakota to Texas, you know, rather than the Northwest or the Northeast or California. That's the map.
Clark Forsyth, Senior Counsel for Americans United for Life, author of Abusive Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade. Clark, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Todd, for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. And Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
We continue our look now at the worldwide refugee crisis and the role of America as we drastically reduce the number of refugees welcomed to our shores. Back in September, WNYC reporter Matt Katz visited a refugee camp in Malawi and saw the crisis through the eyes of a Congolese couple. Here's Matt on our program Monday.
I mean, these people fell in love and dated and got married in the most unimaginably terrible circumstance in the middle of a refugee camp where they don't have indoor plumbing or electricity. And yet they found this magical connection with another person, and now they're not able to experience it in real life.
Andre Twendeli went from that refugee camp in Malawi to Elizabeth, New Jersey. He hasn't seen his wife, Lizette Lukoji, in over a year because she remains in that camp. And while their love story might be rare, their situation, fleeing political persecution only to be frustrated by a stagnating American refugee system, it's increasingly common.
In terms of being separated from a loved one, I mean, that is the story of refugees. And in the time I spent in the refugee camp, I met plenty of people who had relatives who had been able to make it to the U.S. through the refugee program. And now that's complicated because of changes in refugee policy by the Trump administration.
Well, coming to the United States as a refugee is extraordinarily difficult to begin with. But the basis of your story, as you said, is that it's becoming much more difficult now after the first year of the Trump administration. Describe some of the mechanics, some of the policies here, why it's so much harder.
There's big and small changes that have been made. The biggest is in the cap on the number of refugees. In 1980, Congress passed the Refugee Act. That allowed the president to set a number for how many refugees would be admitted every year. And it's fluctuated between 50,000 and about 100,000 every year through Reagan, Bush, Clinton, both parties. President Trump lowered that. Even though we have a cap of 45,000 for the year in terms of refugees being admitted into the country, we're on pace to admit far fewer than that, less than 20,000. And one reason we think is because refugee officers, these are people that fly to refugee camps to interview potential refugees to be resettled in the U.S., those refugee officers who do that work, many of them have been reassigned to the U.S. And that means there's fewer people going to these far-off refugee camps to vet these stories. And that's part of the reason, we believe, for such a low number of refugees being admitted. It's a dramatic drop from what President Obama had said, 110,000. And this comes as the need is greater than it has been since World War II. There's more displaced people around the world than there have been in 75 years.
What about visas for people like Lizette who might follow on their husband like Andre and come to the United States after one member of the family is already here?
The Trump administration decided that the security procedures for a relative were too lax. It was actually slightly easier to get here as a refugee if you had a spouse here. So he suspended the following to join visa, as it's known, just as Lizette was applying here to join her husband in New Jersey.
Well, Matt, we all followed the temporary refugee ban. You said it lasted about 4 months, and we all followed the controversy around the travel ban or the so-called Muslim ban. But if the rationale from President Trump and the administration was to make the country more secure from terrorism, which would be a rational thing to want to do, why has this extended to places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, where as far as I know, there isn't much of a discernible terrorist threat?
No, and that's the irony of all of this. I mean, this is a policy intended to keep out terrorists from Muslim-majority countries. That's what we believe in terms of all the rhetoric we've heard from the president. And yet, we have more Congolese refugees than Syrian and Iraqi refugees. So it affects people who are are from countries that are, have nothing to do with the politics of international terrorism, and yet they've been disproportionately affected by the by these policies. I should also note, by the way, that since the 1980 Refugee Act, there have been zero fatal terrorist attacks committed by refugees on American soil. Zero. The last time a refugee committed a terrorist attack in the U.S. was in the 70s. They were Cuban refugees. So this is not on paper, it seems, a security problem. There doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence that refugees or terrorists are using the refugee system to get into the country like Trojan horses, which is exactly what the president has alleged.
Matt, you flew to Malawi and you visited the Zuleika refugee camp where Andre came from, where Lizette still lives. And talk to a lot of people about the waiting, about the limbo. Here's Elaine Tanta, one of the people you spoke to.
I've been living in limbo for many years now, and I've learned a lot about life. I wanted to send a message maybe for people going to hear this in the United States that not all of us who are very bad, we are not all dangerous. Some people still love United States and still have positive mind to develop the United States.
Matt, Elaine has the idea, it seems, that Americans have been given the impression that he and his fellow persecuted travelers there are a danger to the United States.
Yeah, he understands that that is the reason why he can't get to the U.S. And he was supposed to leave. Him and his 18 relatives were on their way, almost on their way to Minnesota, where he has a brother. They had their travel documents, were ready to go, had been vetted over the course of many years. And then in July, the administration's ban on most refugees went through. So Elaine was not able to get on that plane. And now that the ban has been lifted with new security requirements, that just means Elaine has to apply again. It must be a very jarring emotional experience to think that you're going to be in Minnesota with your loved ones and have a whole new world of opportunity, and yet still find yourself waking up at Zuleika refugee camp in the morning.
You were talking to people at Zuleika left in limbo in that refugee camp. I imagine that they follow the news of refugee policy from this country pretty closely.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in years past, about 1,000 of the 33,000 people who live at Zuleika refugee camp have ended up resettling in the U.S. That number for the past year during the Trump administration is only about 300 or 400. So you really have a less than a 1% chance of getting out of this camp and going to the U.S. But the possibility of that really gives people a reason to get up in the morning and to just try and hope and pray and apply to be a refugee here in America.
Matt Katz reporting on America's refugee system from here in the United States and from a refugee camp in Malawi. Matt Katz with WNYC. Thanks so much, Matt.
Thank you, Todd.
You can listen to all of the reporting from Matt Katz's Unsettled series. It's at WNYC.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. And Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Let's go to Alaska now. On Monday, the Trump administration approved a deal to allow a proposed road running through Alaska's Isimbek National Wildlife Refuge. Locals have fought for the road for decades. Environmental groups say the proposed road would disrupt wild bird habitat and the wilderness there. Previous administrations have blocked the project, but Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke has now signed off, paving the way for the 30-mile road. Della Trumbull is a lifelong resident from the Aleutian Islands. She's a member of the Agdaw tribe of King Cove. She's also the finance manager for the King Cove Corporation and has spent decades advocating for the road. Della, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Well, you've been pushing for this road for decades. Tell me why it's so vital to your town and the other residents of King Cove.
This road, we've been fighting for decades, basically, for safe access between the communities of King Cove and Gull Bay. We have weather that changes drastically in a short amount of time. over the years that allows us to not be able to fly, or in some occasions not to be able to get to by boat to a dock in Cold Bay. Over the years, we've lost 18 people with plane crashes, and one of them was a medevac patient for crab fishermen. And myself personally, I've actually watched my daughter's plane crash land at the field in King Cove. It's just the weather can change pretty fast.
And you and many other residents then are convinced that a new road would sort of get around this problem and allow you to drive safely to the next town.
That is correct. We have a higher percentage of getting to Cold Bay, 99.9% of by any mode of transportation would be by road. Cold Bay is the fourth largest airport in the state of Alaska. It has a 10,000-foot crosswinds runway, and many times you can get in and out of Cold Bay at least 98% of the time of the year.
How do residents around King Cove view the environmental concerns here? The road, of course, would have to cut right through the wildlife refuge. Lots of groups and many people in your area say this risks environmental damage to the wildlife there. I know that's important to you, too. So how do you view the balance here?
Well, basically, there are already roads existing within the wilderness in the refuge system. They were built there during World War II. We don't see a problem with roads within the wilderness. We respect the wildlife and the birds. They're part of who we are. And we've been a part of this system ourselves, our ancestors, for over 4,000 years.
You've mentioned the need for the road for better access to Cold Bay, better access to the airport, especially for people with medical emergencies. As you know, Della, some of the people who are against this road have pointed out that it would also serve the interests of the local fishery industry, like Peter Pan Seafoods, and some of them suspect that that's also playing a large part here.
That isn't the reason. There is nothing behind that. Peter Pan Seafoods has documented that is not why they want this road. Basically, it's safe transportation, safe access between the two communities.
You've lobbied for this new road with many, many administrations, Republican and Democrat, over the decades. Why do you think you hit success with the Trump administration here and with the Interior Department now?
Well, you know, we're really thankful that the secretary and this administration has been willing to work with us and understand that we have a situation that can easily be rectified by a road between the two communities. This road would not have any detrimental impact at all on any wildlife or birds.
And do you suspect that this decision might wind up in court before the road can actually be built?
That's a possibility, yes, but we will continue as we maintained to fight and never let go until we get this access.
Della Trumbull, finance manager for the King Cove Corporation. Della, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All this week, we're looking at President Trump's first year in office and the real policy changes of his administration. Yesterday, we looked at the economy. Today, the courts. When President Trump came into office, he inherited around 100 judicial vacancies, nearly twice as many as President Obama had in his first year. Back in September of 2016, we talked to Russell Wheeler, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution's Governance Studies Program, to forecast how President Trump might change the courts.
Currently, Democratic appointees are majorities on 9 of 13 courts of appeals, and they have a majority among district judges. I would not be surprised that come 2020, that will be, if not reversed, at least there will be Republican majorities on many more courts of appeals, and the district courts overall will probably have more Republican appointees than Democratic appointees.
Well, over a year later now, we caught up with Russell Wheeler to assess Trump's impact so far.
He's appointed 9 district judgeships, which is a pretty small number. He's appointed 12 Court of Appeals judges, but there are today only 2 more Republican-appointed judges on the Court of Appeals than there were on Inauguration Day. For the individual courts with majorities of Republican appointees hasn't changed at all. It's still 4. There's several reasons for that. One is that most of the judges who have left in the last year were Republican appointees, and most of the appointments he made were to courts that already had sizable majorities of Republican appointees. So while obviously that's going to change for the moment, it really doesn't look much different. Now, he's got 12 in place. They will begin to work their effects gradually, but I think at this point we're talking more about potential change than actual change.
And for that potential change, are there a lot of vacancies giving President Trump and a Republican majority in the Senate a big opportunity to reshape the judiciary?
There are 17 vacancies now. Six of them have nominees in place, and there's one nominee for a future vacancy. The Democrats don't have the filibuster anymore, but they do have ways of slowing the machinery down and gumming up the works, and they've been using that. The same kind of factors that mean that the government, you know, had to shut down over the weekend, I think explains the judicial confirmation process. It's just full of polarization.
Well, let's talk about the Supreme Court for a moment. Are conservatives happy looking back with Neil Gorsuch after this first year and the broad strategy by Mitch McConnell and the Republicans to make sure he got on the Supreme Court?
I think they're very happy with Gorsuch. He's turning out to be just what everybody hoped he'd be, and that is in the mold of Antonin Scalia. And they praise McConnell for the tactic that you just mentioned. Whether or not in the long run they're going to look back on that and say that was a good thing is difficult to say, because I'm afraid we may be reaching the point that the only way presidents can get judges confirmed for the Supreme Court or even the Court of Appeals is if the president has a Senate controlled by the same party. And I should point out as well that on the Court of Appeals, the Garland tactic played out in miniature. The Senate confirmed in 2015-16 only two of Obama's appointees to the appellate courts, far fewer than previous 7th and 8th year Senates controlled by the other party had confirmed. And so that's left a bad taste in everyone's mouth as well. So come 2018, if the Democrats take the Senate, I think we could see confirmations just come to a halt.
Well, Russell, you said that the pace of filling vacancies on the federal courts hasn't been too terribly fast under President Trump so far, but that this pace is likely to pick up. Pick up how much? What do you think is in the future for the next year of federal nominations here?
Sure. He has made a record number of nominees to the courts of appeals, 12. One more, I might say, than did Kennedy, Nixon, or Reagan. That pace, actually, I wouldn't characterize that as slow. And if I said slow earlier, I didn't mean it. What I meant to say was, because of the nature of the appointments and who these judges replaced, there hasn't been much of a change in the composition of the appellate judiciary. I can't imagine it's going to have that same pace this year because of all the rancor on Capitol Hill as well as the election coming up. So if he gets another 12 confirmed, I'd be quite surprised.
And the district courts, what about there?
Well, they'll be picked up. I said he's gotten only 9 confirmed so far, which is quite a bit lower than Clinton or Reagan and others who were up in the 20s and the 30s. But he's got quite a few nominees on the executive calendar to get confirmed. So I suspect that might pick up, even if the confirmation of appellate judges slows down a bit, because they're perceived to be more important from a standpoint of judicial policy. I think the district bench will start getting quite a few confirmations.
Russell Wheeler, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Russell Wheeler is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution's Governance Studies program. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. Last week, the magazine In Touch Weekly released a transcript from a 2011 interview with former adult actor Stephanie Clifford. In that interview, Clifford describes in detail an ongoing affair in 2006 with now President Donald Trump. And at the time, now First Lady Melania Trump was at home with their newborn son. Clifford, who appeared in adult films under the name Stormy Daniels, has since reportedly denied the affair, at least according to President Trump's longtime lawyer, Michael Cohen. But there are also credible reports that over the summer of 2016, during the presidential campaign, Trump's camp paid Clifford $130,000 to keep quiet about that relationship. Trump's lawyer and self-described Mr. Fix-It, again, Michael Cohen, set up a shell corporation in Delaware to handle that payment. And a reporter from Slate says he saw the nondisclosure agreement with his own eyes. The president and the White House both deny the affair. Still, one remarkable facet of this salacious story is the relative indifference from the president's conservative evangelical base. Think of the affairs of the American political scene: John Edwards, Newt Gingrich, Bill Clinton. The axe of morality fell hard on all of those men and many, many more. But with President Trump, you might call it a collective shrug from evangelicals. Here's Reverend Franklin Graham over the weekend on MSNBC Live with Alex Witt.
And I don't think it's hypocritical because he's a flawed man for me to try to support him and help him and pray for him. I'm a flawed person, and I would hate for people to see all the baggage I have in my life. But the fact is that God has forgiven me, and I've asked for his forgiveness, and I think the president has too.
Does that sound different to you than what you might have heard in the past from a national evangelical leader like Franklin Graham? There has been a real shift among evangelicals when it comes to the morality of their politicians. We're going to talk about that. Nearly 80% of them voted for President Trump in the election. Professor Barry Hankins is here. He's professor and chair of the Department of History at Baylor University. Barry Hankins, welcome.
Hello, good to be here.
You know, it's hard to imagine a story like this involving the president and an extramarital affair with an adult film actress, a six-figure payment for her silence, with really what amounts to a collective yawn from evangelicals and social conservatives. Do you see it that way? What's going on?
I think over the past 20 or 25 years, really it started in the 1980s when evangelicals became a solid voting bloc within the Republican Party, and have gotten to the position where only a Republican is acceptable for office, largely because of the abortion issue and gay marriage, perhaps, and the other social issues of the culture wars. And I think that especially after the Obama years and the frustrations for conservatives in general and evangelicals in particular, you know, many of the leaders, the evangelical leaders, are willing to make a sort of bargain to support a candidate that embodies all of the things they stood against on the private morality side in order to try and continue the sort of influence that evangelicals have within the Republican Party on these social issues like abortion and gay marriage and the like.
Barry Hankins, you described this shift over the last 25 to 30 years. I'm not sure that I quite agree with that, because there are data that say something a little bit different. From the Public Religion Research Institute, survey data that say in 2011, 30% of evangelicals said an elected official who commits an immoral act in their personal life can still behave ethically and fulfill their duties as an elected official. That number shifted from 30% in 2011 to 72% in 2016. That's not over the last 25 to 30 years. That's over 5 years. It's drastic, and it's a changing of minds that's immediate. Why the flip?
No, the longer-term time frame I was giving was really since the 1980s, when evangelicals have become a solid voting bloc within the Republican Party. The shift on private morality, you're absolutely correct, is very recent, and I think it's driven by Trump. I think once presented with a candidate that will do some of the things they want, and in particular, a couple of things in particular, I think that shift is very recent. It's very dramatic, but I think it's when evangelicals were presented with Trump, they made that decision.
Professor Hankins, you're an evangelical yourself.
I am, except that the evangelical, the way historians define evangelicals, say from the Great Awakening of the 18th century to the present, evangelicalism in America has been a theological and religious movement primarily until about the 1980s, when more and more it became viewed as a political movement. So when one says that he or she is an evangelical, one has to be careful about what they're actually saying, because to the extent that evangelicalism is a political sort of position, I don't have as much in common with other evangelicals as I do on theological issues, biblical issues, these sorts of things. So it's interesting how the term itself, because of evangelical politics, the term itself has sort of morphed in the public eye into something quite different than it used to be.
One of the other parts of what President Trump has to offer his base is this strong thread of ethno-nationalism. And I wonder what you think the role of that is in evangelicals' willingness to put aside the president's private moral behavior to get what they want politically.
Let me just tell you a quick story. When Trump was running in the Republican primaries, I was teaching either world history or my American history survey. So when I get to the run-up of World War II, I'm covering the rise of fascism in Italy and Germany, the way I've covered it for 35 years. And some of my brightest students in that class, their eyebrows went up when I talked about nationalism, ethno-nationalism, making a country great again, these sorts of things. And I almost stopped and said, I've been covering fascism this way for 35 years. Now, do I think Trump is a full-blown fascist? Actually, I don't, because fascists are more consistent, more ideological, and have longer attention spans than Trump has. But this ethno-nationalism is profoundly disturbing. And, you know, the talk about the private morality is one thing, but this is an issue that is of grave concern. And the fact that evangelicals of all people would buy into ethno-nationalism when the Christian message is that believers are brothers and sisters across national, ethnic, racial boundaries is profoundly troubling. It's disheartening that this has happened. And to explain it again, I think that many evangelicals have come to this conclusion that they're under tremendous discrimination. And a lot of this is, it's not just evangelicals, it's others, non-evangelical supporters of Trump and people who are whose lives are dislocated economically and so forth in the past 10 to 20 years. And I understand all of that. There is this tendency, and it's throughout history, where people will latch on to a demagogic leader who will promise them things and at the same time use some implied, if not explicit, scapegoating and innuendo to give people a sense of this is where the problems are. It's an oversimplified thing. And I think it's tragic that people are buying into that. And I think it's doubly disheartening when it's evangelicals who are doing so.
Professor Barry Hankins, Chair of the Department of History, Baylor University. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, is morality an important value in your elected officials? And how much does a politician's sexual history matter to you? Shelley weighed in on our Facebook page. I don't care about sex as long as it's consensual. I do care about hypocrisy and the risk for blackmail and the poor judgment shown by officials taking such risks through hubris or stupidity or both. Tell us what you think. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can join the conversation on our Facebook page. In the meantime, I thank you, as I always do, for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.